You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Parish Council, the official podcast from the Rocking Vicar. It's a beautiful day here in Vicarland, so what better way to spend it than cooped up in a podcast studio, sweltering? But there is some kind of compensation, because his love is lifting us higher and higher. It's my colleague, Terence DeCombe.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. Hello. Very best wishes to you. Do you know, I shouldn't really go out of the house. I really shouldn't. I went out yesterday to the bank, because I'm just, excuse me, hopping over to Ireland for a few days. So I went to get some euros.
Oh, yes.
And you would think that would be a very straightforward transaction. Pop into the bank. Hello, I'm just going for a few days, yep. Like 50 quid's worth of euros. Because, I mean, you can use your card and everything. Yeah, it's just for small change.
Sure.
And you cannot just queue up, go to a counter and say 50 quid in euros, please. First of all, the young lady behind the rather unnecessary, I feel, glass pane.
Bulletproof.
Yes, it's like, yes, exactly. You know, I just want 50 euros. I haven't come to, you know, rob you of everything you've got. But anyway, the same old thing, wanting to make conversation. Oh, where are you going? Oh, just to Ireland for the weekend. Oh, well, I hope the weather's, you know. I mean, she doesn't know I could be going to a funeral. I'm not, but, you know. No. She was also joie de vivre. And, oh, I hope it'll be lovely for you. It's fine in itself.
Yeah.
But two things. First of all, once we've got over this rather lengthy transaction, I mean, to hand over my card, put my PIN number in, give me 50 quid worth of euros, thank you very much, just wanted to go.
Yeah.
She had spent the time while this was going on actually looking up my personal account because she said to me, I see that, you know, she was looking at how much money comes in and goes out each month.
Yeah.
She said, would I be able to interest you in talking to one of my colleagues about setting up an ISA savings package? I mean, I've just gone in there to get 50 quid's worth of euros, and she's trying to sell me stuff. But and I said, oh, that's very kind of you, but no thanks. But here's the strange thing. Whilst all that transaction was going on, she had a blotter in front of her, on her side, obviously, of the glass panel. And she had written on it, I think at this particular bank, they must be given kind of like a daily moral to give to the customers, or a saying, or some such nature that they have to get across to the customers. Because handwritten on her blotter, right at the very top, were the words, "Thank you for helping us to help you." And she had written that the word helping had been underlined.
Right.
So I reckon every day they're told, you know, here's today's catchphrase.
Yes.
And she was supposed to say, "Thank you for helping us to help you." She didn't, because she was too busy trying to sell me the...
for that. No, I'm glad she didn't say that. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, this is called upselling, isn't it? In marketing's parlance, it's upselling. It's the customer comes in with a particular transaction in mind, whether that's, you know, a packet of bags at the corner shop or like you say, a currency exchange in your case. And whilst they're involved in the pre-arranged transaction, you upsell them, you sell them other stuff while they're engaged in that.
So this is like when you go into WH Smith is the worst.
Yes. Do you want a chocolate bar for a quid?
Exactly. You just pop in my case to buy a Daily Telegraph. It actually happened to me this week on Monday.
Yeah.
I popped in, buy a Daily Telegraph.
Yeah.
I just wanted to have that over lunch, do the crossword. And, yes, you're assailed with not only, yes, would you like to buy this chocolate bar for a quid, but instead of just getting a standard receipt now, which, you know, I generally don't want anyway, they give you pages and pages of small bits of paper,
yes,
offering you 50p off back-to-school items,
yeah,
and a pound off pens.
Yeah, a litre and a half of mineral water.
Yes, I just wanted the paper, you know, it's rather like the euros yesterday. Anyway, so that was my experience, but I understand that you two are having issues that are absorbing you at the moment related to a chocolate biscuit you've had for your luncheon.
Yeah, you and I are at loggerheads with the consumer society, I'm afraid. you've been had over royally in the bank getting your currency for Ireland. And I've been had over royally at the supermarket by purchasing a family pack of club biscuits. Anybody who's roughly a similar age range to yourself and I will remember being packed off to school with club biscuits, Jacob's Club.
Can I sing it? Can I sing the thing?
If you must.
If you like a lot of chocolate on your biscuit, join our club.
Which was indeed the marketing motto of the club, Jacob's Club Biscuit. I think Jacob's is one of these sort of not actually a manufacturer anymore, just a brand that's been bought out by, you know, I don't know, Global Foods PLC. But I think they're still Jacob's Club Biscuits. However, they are not in any shape, way or form the same entity that we enjoyed as children. They used to be, you know, a fair old brick, didn't they, a Club Biscuit?
Yeah, you used to get a good old chunk of chocolate on the outer. Yeah. It was a really good bite of chocolate.
Yeah, I can see them now. They were slightly pyramid shape, weren't they? Slightly like inclined sides, didn't they?
Mm, that's right.
But rectangular for all that, with a... The chocolate was so thick they could emboss quite a decent logo in the top, couldn't they?
It had the club logo. And used to, after the initial success, they did branch out into flavours, I seem to remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they're still available. You've got your mint club, you've got your orange club. You got the plain club, which for some reason had a golf ball on the front back in the day, didn't it?
It did, and a raisin version as well.
Well, that's what I've got. That's
the purple raisin.
Yeah, that's
version.
What I've bought this week. It's a family pack of purple raisin club biscuits.
Delicious.
Well, yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you? But really, really, it's sort of like two fingers of a Kit Kat sellotaped together, tasting of the sellotape.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. We don't want that. Oh, that's awful. That reminds me of I bought a Curly Whirly. Not too long ago. And a Curly Whirly used to be a good feed as a kid,
yeah,
didn't
it? The length of a ruler, wasn't it?
Was
12 inches of chocolate and toffee there.
Exactly. Now I suspect it's half that size. The paper packaging may be as long, but when you pull away the paper, you're unfortunately faced with this thin, shortened version of a Curly Whirly that has no similarity to the 60s or 70s original.
No, well, I very, very well recall Terry Scott dressed as a schoolboy brandishing a meter of Curly Whirly at the camera. Yes. Yeah, yeah. No, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, nostalgia ain't what it used to be.
Funnily enough, this very week, and related to this, I think it's Tesco's have been in the news in a good way, in that we talked about last week about marketing for Christmas. They're already beginning to market their family pack tins of Quality Street and Heroes Although members of the public have been are very vocal, because although they're charging the same amount, I think it's £5 a tin, the actual size of the tin has been reduced by something like 20% since last year, which is a bit sneaky, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They did the same with we could go on like this for a long time, but they did the same with muesli in a leading supermarket. My good lady wife enjoys a bowl of muesli of a morning. And we used to buy, let's call it a 2 kilo bag of muesli. I'm not entirely sure the weight, but let's call it a 2 kilo bag of muesli. And it was, £2.39, let's say. So suddenly one day we go and do the shopping and we find the 2 kilo bags of muesli have gone in the place of the 1 kilo bag of muesli, but it's still £2.39.
Good grief. Yeah. That's a hefty cut, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah. And I think it just works on the psychology that, like, oh, people come and they pick up their bag of muesli. Surely they won't notice that half of it's gone. We'll just keep the price the same, you know? A lot of that going on.
We're being, as you say, taken to the cleaners.
We're being had over.
We are. Yeah. Now, Magda Shaw, very rarely does a week go by without something or other being rocked to its very foundations. There's always something, isn't there, being rocked to its very foundations. Mm. And this week we say hello to the world of crime writers, where the phenomenon known as sock puppets has caused much angst and wringing of hands in that very world of crime writers. Before we look at this, I wondered if, for those of us who are not quite so familiar with this practice, what actually is sock puppetry?
Well, it's a very sort of cutesy and pleasant a sobriquet, isn't it, sock puppet? It reminds us, again, of our youth, really, doesn't it? Of our grands or granddads making, I don't know, clangers or wombles or whatever out of old pairs of socks.
It makes me think of Sooty and Sweet, but I think it's a long way from...
It is.
Just the Corbett's friends.
Yeah, because in the digital universe, a sock puppet is an identity that you assume, or indeed invent and assume, in order to travel around the internet, either posting disparaging or downright offensive remarks about other people, or, and this is what's really sort of come to the fore this week, bigging yourself up in various places as if you are a third party under an assumed identity.
So it's like a false account that one would set up then to, as you say, either big up one's own work or put down the work of others.
Yeah.
And hoping that nobody realises that it, you know, that it's not you and that it's some third party that's taking it.
That's right. I mean, it's not very difficult, is it? I mean, you, in some forums, as you post, it just asks you what you want that, you know, what identity you want that post to appear under. Others, you have to sign up, but you can sign up as pretty much anybody. So it's easy to do. And, and you can imagine that the temptation for some people is to, like I say, travel from site to site, leaving good stuff about yourself and bad stuff about others.
Well, this week, Jeremy Dunn,
yes,
the British author of spy and detective works,
yes,
has been doing some detective work of his own, and he uncovered that his, if you like, fellow author of this genre, crime writing, R.J. Ellery, had been undertaking exactly what you were just describing. He'd been using fake identities to write about his own work on Amazon, the website, of course, and under these assumed names, these sock puppet names, giving himself five-star ratings. Indeed, not only that, also writing about his own work under the pseudonyms of Nicodemus Jones and Jellybean. Mm-hmm. And he described one of his own works, which is called A Quiet Belief in Angels. He describes it as this sock puppet described it as a modern masterpiece. Ignore all the dissenters and naysayers. This book is not trying to be anything other than a great story brilliantly told. Whatever else it might do, it will touch your soul. Now, we'd all be delighted to get a review like that for any work that we published on the internet. Yeah. But as I say, unfortunately, this turned out to be Mr. Ellery writing about himself under an assumed name.
Well, I think perhaps we should tread just a little carefully, because I think it would be fairer to say that all the evidence suggests that it is Roger.
Oh, he's admitted it.
Oh, he's
absolutely. He's apologised for a lapse of judgment.
Fair enough.
And he said, I wholeheartedly regret the lapse of judgment that allowed personal opinions to be disseminated in this way, and I would like to apologise to my readers and the writing community.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, fair enough. Yes, a bang to rights then. I mean, what Mr. Dunn did, diligently, was to present the unassailable evidence against R.J. Ellery on Twitter. He wasn't just sounding off and saying, I think the guy's up to this. He was screen grabbing and actually using these internet time machines to go back and see what a page looked like at a certain point in time. And he really did his groundwork, I guess, as you'd expect a detective writer to be able to do.
But absolutely.
He did a fine job of it and got the guy banged to rights. And having done that, I think he's moved on to a couple of other people who seem to be up to exactly the same thing, which just makes me wonder if Mr. Ellery is not the tiniest, tiniest little sliver of a tip of an iceberg.
Well, absolutely, yes. He's also covered another writer called Leather, I think Stephen Leather, who he's found to be doing the same thing. And again, it has, you know, been clarified and admitted. It's not just allegations.
Yeah. So is this common practice, a sort of subculture that's seeped into writing? That a certain sort of writer has latched onto this probably quite a while ago, and has made it part of his daily writing routine to indulge in this nefarious practice. I very much doubt it's just those two writers.
I think you're right. As I think you just said, the tip of a potential iceberg, and that's how it seems at the moment. But what strikes me is that these people don't learn, because it was only a couple of years ago, I recall, the case of, I'm not sure how to pronounce his surname, whether it's Figes or Figes or something, Professor Orlando Figes, I'll call him. He was unmasked as well, I think, via Twitter. Also, exactly the same thing on Amazon, praising his own work, fascinating, uplifting, and then rubbishing his fellows, his rivals, I suppose one would say. And of course, we're only a year now gone since our old chum, what's his name, Johan Hari, yeah, of the Independent, was found and since disappeared, I believe, to America and no longer working for the Independent, where he too had been using a sock puppet account to rubbish other writers, this time I think on their Wikipedia entries.
Right.
My point is they don't learn. You had the Figes thing, then you had the Johan Hari thing, and then this Ellery fellow. People still don't seem to have grasped that on the internet it is possible to track people by IP addresses and also by just people always seem to give themselves away, as Ellery did, by using one of the sock puppet accounts and later signing off the messages with his name, Roger. Kind of gave it away.
Yeah, not particularly smart. Now, and Johan Hari, of course, was also found guilty of plagiarism, wasn't he?
Yes.
Just which one is this better, worse, or otherwise than plagiarism? Or is it just, you know, all horrible sack of fetid stuff that needs throwing out with the garbage?
I think it's the latter, because this Ellery fellow, you see, one could almost say, I was going to suggest to you at one point that, well, you know, bigging up your own work, is it that far removed from going onto Twitter and saying, hey, I've written this piece, would you like to read it? Of course, it's the skullduggery, because you're bigging it up under a different name and pretending to be somebody else. But I think the worst of these issues is the negative stuff that they publish to their rivals. Ellery this week writing about another crime writer, Stuart McBride, and he wrote this last month on Amazon, said, under an assumed name, unfortunately, this is another in the seemingly endless parade of same old police procedurals that seem to abound in the UK. And then giving, you know, his fellow writers one star as their reviews, while giving himself five stars. Yeah. That to me is the worst of it.
Yeah.
Because,
well, I think it's. Sorry, I think there's two scenarios that would mitigate this kind of thing. I think one, it's fine to post under your avatar on Twitter that you've written something, and would anybody like to go and read it? There's nothing wrong with that, because that is a completely neutral position to take. It's just a statement of fact that you've written something, and here's the link to it. And you know, it's for the reader to judge whether what you've written is horse manure or really something quite sparkling. No problem with that at all. The other is scenario, which I think is perfectly acceptable, is to say, I think this could be better. I've seen something here; it's not very good. And to sign off as yourself, that's pretty much okay as well. That's free speech. If you want to vehemently disparage something, I mean, we've disparaged all sorts of work on the podcast here, but we're quite happy to put our names to those comments. So either of those positions quite acceptable. But to use an avatar or a sock puppet, so that A, you don't appear to be the person you say you are, and B, you appear to be a member of the public, if you know, a reader, if you like, to then rubbish another writer's work is cowardly, to say the very, very least, you know, deceptive and underhand. Also, to post links to your work as if you're somebody else and describe it as brilliant and breathtaking and life-changing, that is also reprehensible. So either you're an avatar and you're totally neutral in posting the link, or you're yourself, and therefore you're entitled to say anything you like.
I think what will be interesting will be to see whether this particularly R.J. Ellery, of who I must say his work had never crossed my path. It's not a particular area that I read, crime novels, whatever. But it'd be interesting to see whether his sales suffer in any way, or his profile or his personal reputation is damaged more than just for this few days, and whether he can bounce back. And that's something obviously we'll only be able to establish over a period of time. Very interesting that it's drawn out a whole bunch, I think about 50 British writers, including Val McDermid, Ian Rankin and Mark Billingham, who was actually one of those targeted by Ellery, and they've sent a sort of public letter out, not unnaturally condemning the practice in total, and they, you know, as a group, committing never to use these tactics.
Absolutely.
As they say.
Yeah,
and we shall see in time whether it affects the careers of Mr. Leather and Mr. Ellery.
Well, yeah, perhaps it should. And as both you and I know, writing is a tough old game, you know, and to find an outlet for your work is hard enough without you know, somebody indulging in nefarious practices to do you down. And I think, you know, if anything, writers should support each other. Yeah, be critical, but do so publicly and transparently, but also to support each other. And this just is horrible. It leaves a bad taste in your mouth, doesn't it, really?
It does. Yeah. Now, you spotted in the reporting of this, I think, again, a very old-fashioned way of it being presented in some of the papers, including the references to the use of Twitter for the establishment of this story.
Yeah, this was really rather interesting. They weren't the only offenders by any means, but this is what got me thinking, was that the Telegraph, in reporting this sock puppet story that had been uncovered by Jeremy Dunn, just used this phrase which might, you know, quite easily pass you by, but that just stuck in my craw a little. They said the story was broken on Twitter, of all places. Now, it's just those three words, "of all places," that set me thinking that there is something of a malaise running through the traditional, or the I don't know what we'll call it now, but the analog or the old style media, that they regard social media, and particularly Twitter, as something of a flash in the pan, or a game, or something for kids, or certainly not something to be taken seriously. And more fool them, really, because, as we know, and here's the perfect example, that really intriguing, interesting, and real-time stories break on Twitter all the time. And if broadsheet newspapers are thinking that this service is something to dismiss or to rubbish, or that will disappear in the fullness of time, is A, making them look stupid, and B, betrays their lack of a grasp on digital media and the way media reporting is drifting.
I don't know what they would have expected Jeremy Dunn's to have done to get this story out. Did they expect him to perhaps send it in by letter to the Telegraph and say, look what I've uncovered? I don't know, but that does seem a very old-fashioned attitude. There's one, in fact, one of their rivals, one of the most leading newspapers in the country, that's famous as much for its website these days as for its print edition, seems to generate a majority of the stories it runs on that website from Twitter, including lengthy quotes from tweets.
Yeah.
Which really is, there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, that's the way forward.
Well, so yeah, exactly, yeah. And I noticed a Private Eye, who I'm normally an enormous fan of, have been a bit guilty of this as well. They've certainly in their latest edition, running a column laughing at papers that quote tweets. Stories that quote tweets, as if, you know, papers have somehow gone a bit down market by engaging with Twitter, which is ludicrous, because what you have in Twitter is a real-time, citizen-generated, or everyone-generated newsfeed.
Well, earlier this week, the Prime Minister himself was actually, or someone on his behalf, I'm pretty sure it wasn't David Cameron, actually hitting the keys. But the reshuffle, his cabinet shuffle, I think it should be, not reshuffle. I get a bit annoyed about this shuffle, reshuffle thing. But anyway, his rearrangement of his cabinet was announced via Twitter. Yeah, it was the first place where the changes were posted.
Well, quite so. And I think maybe... Two and a half years ago, politicians thought that YouTube was going to be the channel for them. That it was very important that somebody, you know, pulled up with a sort of mid-range camcorder and filmed them in their office pronouncing on this, that, and the other, and everybody would go and watch it. But that hasn't really taken off, has it? I don't know anybody who rushes to YouTube to watch some you know, minor transport minister talking about the painting of white lines. But people certainly check Twitter all the time to see who in power is saying what about whom and why they're saying it. So it's those 140 characters seem to be much more able to capture the public imagination than the all singing and all dancing corporate video, don't they?
And I've got a good example for the Daily Telegraph and any other naysayers of the power of Twitter. And indeed, it also exemplifies that some of those using Twitter accounts, again, don't realise the power at their disposal. Mm. And my example is the pop star Rihanna.
Oh, yes.
Riri, yeah. Yeah. Is she the umbrella lady?
She's the umbrella lady.
Posted a photo of herself at St Pancras Station in London last Saturday on Twitter, saying that she was about to take a train to Paris.
Right.
Now, you may be one step ahead of me because she has 25 million Twitter followers.
Yes.
So not unnaturally, as her, she also mentioned her train departure time.
Oh, dear.
And a sign, I think, of St Pancras Station, a photo of herself and saying that she was about to get to Paris. So, not surprisingly, when she turned up at Gare du Nord late on Saturday evening, fans were there by the bucket load to what they thought to welcome her and greet her.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, of course, this event, as it now turned out to be, hadn't been pre-arranged, so the very small team of security at Eurostar who were there just to sort of direct people hither and thither, and her own one or two bodyguards that travel with her, of course, struggled to protect her from the absolute crush of people around her. But Rihanna, not realising that she was the mistress of her own downfall, then sent out a string of tweets with swear words all over them, complaining about the pushing of the crowd as she'd left the station. And she's one tweet said, "I just had to fight my way out of a damn train station." she was there to perform with Coldplay. So I think the next day at the Stade de France. But again, it just shows that... not only are media places underestimating the power of Twitter, but people with Twitter accounts and indeed with 25 million followers should be careful about what they say.
Yes, I think those bodyguards who travel with her should also take her iPhone off her.
whilst in transit.
Should. Yeah. And I don't need convincing of this. I think I'm... on the off chance I've told this story on the podcast before, I will just bounce through it, but it is relevant here. Is you remember the absolutely dreadful earthquake in Japan, a year and a half ago, something like that?
That also caused the nuclear blast.
Absolutely. So, well, the morning our time that's happened, I was in Huddersfield, of all places, in North Yorkshire, and just as I was leaving the house, I heard there'd been an earthquake in Japan, but that's all I'd heard. I didn't know the catastrophic scale of this thing. And waiting for the train back from Huddersfield, just stood on the platform there, chilly day, as I recall, I just fished out my phone and thought, I'll browse Twitter while I'm waiting for this train to come. Anyway, it was ram-packed full of reports, mainly from the media outlets, Sky and the BBC, such like, about what had happened. I realised how dreadful this earthquake had been. However, one person following me, and who I follow as well, was in Tokyo. And he tweeted that he'd just been told to leave his apartment block and he was out in the streets and that there were still huge aftershocks happening every few minutes. And so I tweeted him and said, you know, dear Lord, I don't know the guy, you know, he's just somebody who you know, we've encountered each other on Twitter. And I said, dear Lord, you know, I do hope you're all right. Do hope there's some way you can get to safety. And he tweeted me back, yeah, I'm not in a bad place. And then for about the following hour, I tweeted in real time, this guy in Tokyo, and he was tweeting me back. And I was getting the most profound and most, perhaps the wrong word, but exhilarating and visceral account of what was happening in Tokyo, which I could not hope to get from any other media outlet. I could ask questions and interact with somebody in real time who was stood in the middle of the earthquake in Tokyo. And I thought, well, this is really where we've arrived at something extraordinary here in communications. And that just convinced me that news organizations needed to be looking to their laurels, because I was not engaged with any of the major news providers at all. I was engaged with somebody who was living through this earthquake.
Whereas, looking from what you told us earlier about the Telegraph's response, they would, some, or at least some members of their hierarchy would prefer one of their reporters out on the scene to perhaps phone in a report and gets typed up and gets printed in tomorrow's paper.
Yeah, the next day.
You were interacting literally as the situation was unfolding.
Absolutely.
You're right on it. Yeah.
Yes, and they were probably putting that report, and some people followed the earthquake on Twitter, of all places.
This week, Magnus Shaw, not for the first time, ITV have relaunched their breakfast programme, Daybreak, and replacing Kate Garraway and your mate, Dan Lobb, with Lorraine Kelly and Alec Jones.
Yeah.
And I know we've both watched the relaunch version this week. I watched yesterday. I think you watched a bit today. I tuned in at 7:58 earlier in the week. As I say, usual thing, sponsored weather forecast by Deep Heat, the medical lotion of all things, to quote the take the Telegraph phrase of all things, of all things Deep Heat. I noticed once more that broadcasters are obsessed with weather reports, because within minutes of the national weather on this Daybreak, we cut to the weather for your area.
Yeah.
That's just by the by, but they do that on all news programs. Anyway, this was a strange programme. I don't normally watch breakfast TV, so I know it was a relaunch and we watched it specifically for that. I don't normally watch it. So desperate to give an air of bonhomie, Alec Jones. He brought the news headlines. He told the news headlines. It was a really sad story about a death on a boat in Norfolk. But he was giving this story whilst giving a broad, toothy grin. His face was locked into this white, shiny, toothy grin, which didn't really work at all. But as usual with ITV breakfast shows, it's all about vivid colours. And my God, this set is dominated by an orange hue. Not a muted orange, but an eye-piercing tango orange. And echoes of the This Week setters, Alid and Lorena, jammed in together on the sofa. You watched it on a different day. What did you make of Daybreak on ITV with Lorraine and Alec?
Well, I did notice the set, and I think it was quite obvious, it certainly was to me, that they'd gone through the notes of the disaster that was the launch of Daybreak with Christine and Adrian. How long ago was that? Is that 18 months, something like that ago?
Gotta be, isn't it? Something like... they stopped, I think, in January 2011.
So something like that. And I think they probably, well, what were the pitfalls there? And one of the notes must have said, set terribly dark, which it was in the early days of Daybreak. And so they went, right, we'll fix that. Just go out and get me some lime green and orange paint immediately. So you can see they were just taking the juxtaposition, really. At least they can't accuse us of being dark. It was semi-confirmed on the radio yesterday. Alan's had his teeth fixed for this new gig. Yeah,
because they were very, very white and shiny.
So yeah, and I think he's had some kind. He's been to the same clinic as Mr. Cowell, perhaps, for that.
Yes, yeah. My goodness. Yes.
So I guess he grinned through every story through nerves. To be fair, I mean he's done a lot of television, but nothing quite on the scale of what sort of the best part of 3 hours live every day. That's a big gig for anybody. So I guess his grinning was possibly down to nerves.
We'll forgive him that.
Well, yeah, indeed. This isn't necessarily a wholly original thought, but it was one I heard yesterday on this subject, which I'd really agreed with. That hadn't necessarily occurred to me before. Is that Breakfast TV has never worked in the UK, with the possible exception of The Big Breakfast, but we just haven't taken to it at all. All these years later, in the mid-80s, when this new concept arose with TVAM and then Breakfast Time on the BBC, and no matter how many times they wrestle with the format and try new things and new presenters, new timings and all the rest of it, we just don't take to it. I think the British turn the radio on in the morning and the Americans turn the telly on. I mean, breakfast television in America is the king of the day. You know, if you've got the anchor spot on the breakfast show, you're the king of that station. But it's an afterthought in the UK because we've never really taken to it. And I haven't really occurred to me until somebody mentioned it yesterday. No, we haven't really. The closest we've ever got to getting it right was The Big Breakfast, but that was a youth program. And it's figures were never, earth-shattering. It was just thought of as, by a certain type of person, as great fun and very well done. But you can't, it wasn't world-conquering. And so I don't think any breakfast telly show has really happened properly in this country. And I wonder if this is going to be any different. In fact, I'm sure it won't be.
I'm sure it won't be too. Do you think the reason that breakfast TV is a hit in America and not here now, you can have a laugh at my expense by all means, I don't know. But is it because American homes generally are bigger and therefore they tend to have more televisions? I still don't think, certainly in my circle of friends and family, people don't tend to have televisions in their kitchens. I know some people do, but generally people don't.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, again from my experience, go to American homes, they tend to have televisions in the kitchen and the bedrooms.
Yeah.
And so you can move from room to room is what I'm getting at and still keep in touch.
Whereas we
don't do that.
No, I think there's probably something to that. And I just think programming at that time of day in the States has just got more of a cultural cachet. It just has more weight in terms of its positioning in the schedule. So the breakfast show is, it is like the radio breakfast show, the FM radio breakfast show in the UK, which is all conquering. And it's the same for TV in America. And here we just don't buy into it, as I say.
Breakfast TV in America that I've seen, and again, I may not have seen of a wide range, but when I have seen it, tends to concentrate, I believe, on news stories.
Yeah.
They may be, within them, there may be light-hearted news stories, but they're still news stories. We're still in a place here in the UK where we see breakfast TV as nothing more than a series of people moving on and off the sofas, plugging their new single, their new play, their new film, and that was certainly the case when I watched Daybreak earlier in the week. It was saved by the Paralympics because they had an interview with Alla Davis, not Alla Jones, Alla Davis, Paralympic gold medal winner, which worked well, actually, due to him being articulate. But you see, of course, then we had to have the human interest bit. So we had to have a video link up with his mother back in Wales. Yes. And those things, they rarely work because the participants are always awkward in public. You know, faced with your mum and your brother, as he was, suddenly from Wales. People don't know what to say because they're used to a private relationship with
quite
their family.
So, yeah. Yes, I think that's right. I think the content is different. And we don't go for the hard news at breakfast. Where BBC goes more newsy at breakfast than ITV ever have, but we don't tend to go hard newsy because I think we think it'll put people off. In America, they have no problem at all getting the general populace, even the less sort of worldly populace, to engage with the news. News is, particularly television news, is a huge attractant in America. I wouldn't begin to attempt to explain why that is, but you know, in this country, the cry tends to be, is anything on? No, only the news. In America, that is when people will gather to watch the news bulletin, and the news anchors in America are the stars of television. There's no, you know, there's no bigger TV star than the big national news anchor. So, but we shy away from that, and like you say, yes, we just set up an acid green sofa and have a constant troop of Max Clifford's clients filing past. The morning I watched it, I was most surprised to see them plugging right up until it happened, in order to keep people with the show, the fact that they were going to have Little Mix on. That was their big you know, launch, and I watched the launch edition. Their big launch edition pull was, it can't be that Little hard Mix. To get Little Mix on. For goodness,
no.
You know, it can't really be difficult. And that was their big, they were plugging it as if they had got Barack Obama with them. And that just seemed ridiculous to me.
And I would have thought the audience, I mean, again, I know the audience was only about 600,000 for the launch day.
Yes.
But of that 600,000, I wonder how many would be natural Little Mix followers.
Oh, very few.
Yeah, I would have thought so too. I wouldn't have thought, well, Little Mix fans, largely, 13 to 17-year-olds. I can't imagine them sitting down and absorbing their performance of their new single. But it is a big chance. I don't think it'll work, but it is a big chance for ITV to pull ahead because BBC Breakfast, I just watched a little part of that. Again, as I say, I'm no expert. I don't watch these programs. But I thought BBC Breakfast was looking very tired when I switched over. And I think ITV should hoover up the big name guests because it seems to be nobody wants to make that trek to Salford for BBC Breakfast for 3 minutes on the BBC sofa. Daybreak is in London.
Yeah.
But a point I just wanted to bring to your attention, on the day I watched it, there was a real oddity because Daybreak, as I say, is live from Central London Studios. But they had live Jude Law and Keira Knightley, of course, there to plug a movie. But they were interviewed live from a hotel about a mile away in London.
Oh.
And so probably they were there for a day of press interviews. You know what they do? They take out a hotel suite, don't they? And then reporters file in and out all day, getting their 10 or 15 minutes. So it was probably part of that process. But it was strange, I thought, that a compromise couldn't be found to place the interviewer and the interviewees in the same room when they were about a mile apart.
Yeah.
And this was breakfast TV. But I wonder as well whether that reflected the point you made earlier, which is that actually nobody cares. And that given the opportunity to say, well, look, you're in such and such a hotel for the day doing these interviews. We'll get you a limo. We'll take you a mile to Daybreak Studios and bring you straight back. And they probably went, meh.
No, exactly. Nah, yeah, I think that's exactly right. It shows the esteem or lack of it that breakfast on ITV is held, that their agent didn't say, yeah, you've got to do that. You've got to take this as a courtesy car and go and be on the sofa. I think their agent probably said, either they'll come to us or it won't happen. It doesn't matter much. And as you just pointed out, and I think perhaps the elephant in the room that you nodded to a few moments ago is when you said the opening show of the relaunch Daybreak drew 600,000 viewers?
600,000 viewers.
But that is dreadful.
Terrible,
that
isn't it?
That is dreadful. I mean, CBeebies must get more than that. Very considerably.
Well, BBC Breakfast gets about 1.5 million.
Yes. Yeah. Nothing to write home about either.
No, it's not at all. Well, not against Moyles and Chris Evans, who are what, 5, 6, 7 million.
Quite so. Yes. 600,000 is. I mean, I'm not sure how they compile ratings these days for telly, but there was certainly a point where to drop much under a million would count as zero audience in TV ratings.
I think they should give up. I honestly think they should give up and just run a series perhaps of pop videos interspersed with a rolling banner of news headlines or something.
I don't think it could do any worse. No, I mean, when the Big Breakfast came off, Channel 4 tried something called Rise, which was catastrophic. And when that came to an end, Channel 4 gave up the ghost and said, you know what, we're going to run that Raymond show, whatever everybody loves Raymond, Frasier, and Bits and Bobs, until the day sort of starts to pick up. And that's what they did, and I don't think they've suffered at all for it.
Well, I left them to it. I stuck with it for about half an hour. I left them to it at 8:30 in the morning as Lorraine handed over to herself, which was, again, a bit mind-boggling.
So she does the follow-on show as
she
well?
She does the follow-on show as well. Yeah, she hands over to herself. She drops Aled and then moves over to herself at 8:30.
That's very true. Now, I know somebody, in fact, I'm related to somebody who works on Daybreak. So I've really had to bounce across the things I've said about it, and I can't really relate on the podcast all the things that I do know about behind the scenes at Daybreak. The things that you've said are not far wrong, and that's as far as I can probably take it. But
well, a couple of days later, all I can say, my eyes are still burning from the orange walls, orange floor, orange everything.
I'm sure, like I said, that is in fear of being accused of darkness.
Well, Magnus Shaw, it's time for the ever popular and much commented on Pretend I've...
Yes.
Which does seem to gain in popularity from messages we receive week on week.
Yeah. Have you switched it on? Hold on, let's just switch it on there.
Okay.
Oh, low battery. Hold on, I'll put it in the wall. There you go. There you go. It's charging now, that's it. Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
What have you brought for us this week?
This week I have brought a track by a band that everybody will know, and it's probably a song that everybody knows as well. And the name of the band... You may know them too. The Doors.
Oh, got to have a bit of The Doors. That's a great choice.
You'll be familiar with The Doors. They get quite an unfair and harsh rap, though, don't they, The Doors? I don't think you read music magazines of the Mojo ilk, let's say, and they can't wait to have a pop at The Doors and groan about the Doors' output. And I think that's wildly unfair. There's no doubt at all that Jim Morrison could be a dreadful oaf. Dreadful oaf, quite unpleasant to his various girlfriends and to the band members as well, and a pretentious oaf at that.
Well, you see, this is all going to depend on the track you're going to pick, because the Doors are a band that are only as good, in my view, as their greatest hits. A Doors album would not, a standard studio album would not engage me at all. So for me, they're something of a singles band, and there's probably three or four tracks that I would say are sort of heritage classics. Yeah. So I shall reserve judgment to see what you're going to do.
Well, I mean, just my point would be anybody who refers to themselves as the Lizard King, he's got to be a little bit annoying, hasn't he? He's going to bug.
Yeah, that would get a bit tiresome down the pub.
Exactly. Yeah, he's going to bug you a little bit. But all that said, that I think the output of the Doors, certainly as you say, the cream of the Doors, stands up with any of the great rock bands. And I think it's all too easy to dismiss the Doors as something distasteful, because they did some, look at Light My Fire, which is not the track that I've picked, but just let's look at Light My Fire. That has become a standard that you can hear anywhere from your local karaoke bar through to Jose Feliciano albums and even Will Young. Light My Fire, absolutely, the list of people who've covered that must fill a room. And so you've got to hand that to them for a start. Light My Fire, of course, off the first album, which was, for me, you say they're not an albums band, but that first album's a runaway killer for me. Every track has something to offer. A superb debut album, never matched by the Doors. But I think people tend to look at Jim Morrison and say, well, he was a bit of a doofus, so they must be a bad band. But what you got to do is look slightly to Jim's right and look at the guy playing keys. Ray Manzarek, absolute musical genius, classically trained. Played the Fender Rhodes piano on all the Doors stuff, wrote all the arrangements and backing to go with the Lizard King's poetry. And but I don't know, do you know this? I've certainly told people this and they've been surprised. All the bass parts on the Doors records were played by Ray Manzarek on bass pedals whilst he played the melodies on the keys. Do you know that?
I didn't know that. Yeah, I do know that old friends from the Wrecking Crew occasionally added to the Doors hits. Yeah. But no, I didn't know that.
They didn't have a bass player. Ray played all the bass parts on bass pedals as he was playing those absolutely intricate and virtuoso key parts on the Fender Rhodes piano. Anyway, I digress.
I think Carol Kay from the Wrecking Crew might want to have a word with you
about
that.
Oh, did she? She did some bass guitar, did she? So certainly in concerts, Ray was on the bass pedals. So.
Okay.
Anyway, you can hear him on this song that I've picked. Perhaps it's his most creative. It's the last song the Doors ever recorded together. Certainly with Jim. They did some stuff without Jim, but I think we can gloss over that. And the song is Riders on the Storm.
Is that really? I really didn't know that. That was the last song they recorded together as a unit with Morrison. That's amazing. What a way to finish. Absolutely. Sorry to interrupt, but my giddy up.
Absolutely, yeah. There's nothing like going out on a high. It wasn't intended to be the last song they did together. Jim and his girlfriend Pam ran off to Paris when Jim closed his account, so there was no more recording with the Doors. The track comes complete with its own brilliant thunderstorm sound effects there. No cheap hammer horror stuff there. It's a real proper growling, rolling thunderstorm that indeed opens the track and runs all the way through it. And by all accounts, Jim sang the lyric and then went back and whispered over the lyric, the same lyric, but whispered over his sung track, which gives it that sort of roomy, echoey reverb effect, which sort of reverberates with the thunder you can hear. It's almost supernaturally atmospheric, this track. And whenever I hear it, wherever I am, I'm on a train, whether I'm in the middle of a town, whether I'm in a bar, whether I'm in the countryside, I'm suddenly not. Suddenly I'm in the dead of night, perhaps in a dingy motel in the deep south of America, while one of those sort of three-day storms, rainstorms, just plummets and floods around me. It absolutely transports you. It's sort of like a horror film as a rock song, I'd say. That's that hypnotic. And the lyrics talk about a guy hitchhiking in this appalling thunderstorm looking to kill people. So it's cheery stuff. But strange enough, it's really relaxing. You could almost say it's an ambient record if you ignore the murderous lyrics there. And so it's really for its atmosphere. One of the most atmospheric records I think I've ever heard that leads me to pick it for the Pretend iPod. Recorded at the Doors' own workshop studio, December 1970. Then released in 71 as a single and part of the LA Woman album, possibly the best thing the Doors ever did. It's Riders on the Storm.
With you all the way, beautifully described, if I may say as well. And I think it's the best thing they ever did. And it's, again, one of those songs that's almost certainly in my top 20 of all time. And I so agree with you about the evocative nature of it. And I'm delighted that it was recorded in an age before we had videos to accompany songs.
Yes.
Because just like you, no matter where I am when I hear this, whether I'm in the car or at home or wherever, that the sound effects and the total ambience of the thing transports me, I think, probably almost to the same scenario that you painted. I'm somewhere in the sort of southern states of America and the rain is cascading down, and then Jim Morrison describing the scene. Absolutely stunning, and I think it's an absolutely worthy pick for the old Pretend iPod.
Well, thank you kindly.
Okay. Now, the death of the phenomenal lyric writer Hal David has been well covered in the media this week.
Yes, yes, yeah, I'd add our meagre voice to that, yeah.
And it's led to further plays of his delicious words on Do You Know the Way to San Jose, Say a Little Prayer, Walk on By, and many, many, many others. I'm not picking a Hal David track this week, but if we seek out a British equivalent of a British songwriter who shares that gift of being able to relate to life and all its ups and downs in maybe 3 minutes, then I think we must turn to Ray Davies of the Kinks.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Absolutely. Golden run of singles from 1964 to 1970, including Dedicated Follower of Fashion, Sunny Afternoon, Waterloo Sunset, Lola. However, for this week's choice, I'm turning to 1967. And during the summer, Ray Davies watches from his window and a local man comes to tend to his garden. And in his quirky biography, X-Ray, which I reread this week, Ray Davies says, and I quote about this man, "He tended the garden with loving care, and as the seasons changed, he swept up the dead leaves and prepared the garden for the next life cycle. Watching him always made me feel optimistic about the future, that there was always a better day coming." And thus from that formed the inspiration for one of my favourite Kinks songs, Autumn Almanac, which is my pick this week. A very, very British song, inspired by the change of season from summer to autumn, of course, but also a broader reflection on life in the UK, as seen from the perspective of 1967. It has one of the great opening lines of any song ever. "From the dew-soaked hedge creeps a crawly caterpillar. When the dawn begins to crack, it's all part of my autumn almanac." What a great line. "From the dew-soaked hedge creeps a crawly caterpillar." And then another great couple of evocative lines later in the song. "Tea and toasted buttered currant buns can't compensate for the lack of sun, 'cause the summer's all gone." So a lovely, wistful, mellow song to listen to as the crystals of summer shiver into fragments, recorded in September 1967 at Pye Studios in London, reached number 3 in the UK Top 40 in October 1967. Again, an amazing contrast with today. Recorded in September 67, released in October 67, and number 3 in the charts in October 67. Nowhere at all in the Billboard Hot 100. 3 minutes, 6 seconds, The Kinks and Autumn Almanac.
Yeah, it's a really good pick, isn't it? And although Ray Davies is, of course, widely admired, he's not really a household name, is he? He falls just short of the Mick Jagger, Paul McCartney sort of, you know, man on the Clapham omnibus would know him.
You're absolutely right. He's not in the Champions League places in the Premiership. No. He's just down mid-table.
Yeah, but he certainly should be. Perhaps it's because he never played the sort of sexy rock star game. He was always a little more left field, wasn't he? And
very much so. And their success, again, you know, they're one of those bands, I often talk about this, that, you know, have a golden run. And theirs was sort of 64 to 70. And apart from one brief further splash in the spotlight with Come Dancing in the 80s.
Yes.
That was it for them, really. So they've been rather a heritage act since then. And, of course, to add to their woes, there's been something of a difficult relationship between Ray Davies and his brother Dave Davies, also in the Kinks. And so that's kind of added to the issues over the years. They haven't even produced a studio album since 1993,
right.
So we are looking back a long way now.
Yeah, indeed. But he's still a master of the form. I caught him 2 summers ago now at the Cornbury Festival, and my good lady wife had the pleasure of meeting him as well. So he is still going strong and a charming fella by all accounts. So
He did a solo set?
He did a solo set, yeah, that's right, yes, yeah. And my wife was doing some photography at the festival and ran into him backstage. And they're very unassuming, very nice fella. And
that's good to
very
hear.
Polite to us. So, yeah, good pick, Autumn Almanac. Great, great. We shall get that up on the Pretend iPod. So, well, thank you very much for that, Terence. And that brings us to the end of the podcast for this week, I'm afraid. Now, we are away next week, so you can stand down, sir. You can get back to building that model battle cruiser. you've been so neglecting. But we'll relish your company in a fortnight. And, of course, you at home. We'll look forward to seeing you then as well. But until then, thanks very much for your company. See you, as I say, in a fortnight. Bye-bye.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone and packed her out alone. Riders on the storm. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday. Let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer on the road.
Production.